Welcome to Small Bites Radio with Donato Marino and Derek Tim. We hope you're hungry.
Raw spaghetti you can eat with a spoon. Oh, SpaghettiOs.
Hit it.
Where's the beef?
Cookie.
He likes it.
Nothing for you. Nothing for you. Nothing for you.
Feed me more.
Long as I can have you here with me, I'd much rather be forever in blue jeans, babe.
Welcome, everybody, to Wildfire Radio, Small Bites, with Derek Tim of BlueJeanFood.com and Donato Marino of DNL Coffee to Bean Barista Service. You can reach us on Facebook, and you can reach Derek on
just Blue anywhere, Jean. Any corner.
Yeah, true.
Any corner around the block.
Just look.
But how about that fly, Eagles fly, Don?
The Eagles did a phenomenal job today.
Yes, indeed. And
they started out weak.
But
they got a little pep talk at halftime.
But they came and they rose and overcame odds. And also, I want to congratulate everyone on the Wildfire team and the Small Bites team. It was announced last week that not only are we the number one listed food radio show in Philadelphia, we are also the number one listed food radio show South Jersey as well. So thank you to everyone who contributes on the show. I know you guys do a lot of hard work behind the scenes, and it's always much appreciated. But one of the people who always gets the most accolades, I would say. Would you agree with that, Don?
I would agree.
Yeah. And that is John Howard Fusco, the nightlife correspondent for the Courier-Post, and also his wonderfully recognized blog, Eating in SJ, from the New York Times. What's going on, buddy? You are probably our most popular segment producer. Every show I go on to, they're always asking, can we have John on? And then they kick me out of studio. How's it going, buddy?
And I keep telling everyone, I don't come cheap, so, you know, if you're going to... So let's get to the news from this past week. I want to mention a restaurant called Zagafen. This is a new restaurant in Ballard-Kinwood that serves kosher pizza along with veggie and fish small plates. Philly Mag is reporting that the menu also includes dishes made with dairy products from milk that was produced under rabbinic supervision. They actually have two separate kitchens to prepare both kosher and non-kosher food. The full menu is available at Philly Mag as well. Two new restaurants to keep on your radar coming down the road. Gabby is a new French cafe from Chef Peter Woolsey of Bistro La Minette that will be opening on North Broad sometime in October. And also we have the Arbor Room, which is a seafood restaurant and raw bar from Lee Steyer. They'll be opening upstairs from his own restaurant Fond on East Passyunk, but you're going to have to wait until next year, according to Philly Mag. Hello, Donuts and Coffee is a new donut shop in Kensington. That's right, Derek, I said Kensington, that serves traditional and vegan donuts, as reported by Michael Klein in Philly.com. Specialties of the house include a blueberry cheesecake donut and a flower power donut, which includes orange blossom and jasmine. Over on the Jersey side, the owners of Pop Shop in Collinswood, Stink Fisher and Connie Correa, announced this past week that they would be selling the restaurant after 14 years, but they'll be selling it to the partners who are currently running the Medford location of the Pop Shop, so it's kind of staying in family, so to speak. And something closer to where I live, Caffrey's Tavern in Forked River is anticipating a late September opening, a little more than a year after a fire closed the local legendary restaurant and bar. So that'll be very happy news for people around where I live. So these stories and more from the past week in Philly food will be posted on my blog and shared on Twitter at EatingNestJersey. As always, hashtag Small Bites Radio. And if you want to come see me at a book signing, I will be down in Cape May this Saturday the 14th from 11 to 2 at the Physic Estate as part of the Harvest Brew Festival. So come down, say hello, buy a book for yourself and 50 of your closest friends.
Oh, I agree 100%. 50 friends. Buy
50
for everybody.
Yeah.
Buy it for 100. But thank you so much, John. It's always a pleasure. You're always a wealth of knowledge, and great talking to you again.
All right, guys. Have a good night.
You too.
Good night, John.
But talking about all that different news, we've got wonderful news here in studio.
We do.
I didn't want to get started because we tease John and we joke with him about times that we have food in studio. But
you didn't have the heart to tell him this time.
I didn't have the heart because the gentleman who's in studio, he spoiled us completely. I mean, this was a wonderful spread.
50 boxes of goodness.
And in studio would be, and don't take it wrong because I'm a butcher of last names, but we'll do the best that we can. David Wiederholt?
Wiederholt would be correct. Wiederholt, if you're in German, but it's close enough.
I should be ashamed of myself. My German side of my bloodline is ashamed of myself. But he is the chef owner of David and Sons 322 Barbecue. They have two locations, one in Mullica Hill, which is just turned one, and Swedesboro, which is 5 years old. Before we get started with your story and background and all this other good stuff about your restaurant, tell everyone who can't see, because obviously this is radio, what you brought in studio for us.
Well, we brought a lot of stuff. We started off with our whole hog package, which is built for like 12 to 16 people. So it's our 12-hour smoked brisket, 12-hour smoked pulled pork, baby back ribs, chipotle pulled chicken, wings, and whatever four sides you think you might like. And then we threw on top of it, we threw our redneck egg rolls in there, we threw our triple smoked candy bacon in there, and our jalapeno poppers, which are stuffed with a blue cheese, bacon, and Vidalia onion mix, which is dynamite.
And this is perfect for this time of year, because this is the sort of thing that anyone who's listening, any given Sunday, you're going to invite your friends over, and like you said, 12 to 14 people, you're going to look like a hero.
Yeah, we make everybody look like a hero. You want to look like the superstar for your party, you bring us in. We do this every day, all the time.
Yeah, I mean, Don.
Nice tailgating event. I mean, just throw a grill out, throw some charcoal, and
pretend like you cooked
it
yourself.
Real good, and come out with it.
You weren't in studio, Don. We were joking around that anything left over, it might be advertised barbecue night at Terry's too. But
that's okay.
We want to make sure these labels stay on here.
Yes.
But thank you so much. That was generous, and everything is wonderful. Before we get into 322 Barbecue, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Let's see. I grew up in the Midwest, born in North Dakota, which is completely odd. Nobody knows anybody from North Dakota, it seems like. I grew up in Colorado and Wyoming, for the most part. Came out to the East Coast to go to the Culinary Institute of America in upstate New York. Met a girl from New Jersey. And
the rest is history.
Drugged my ass down here, yeah.
Cuban took over.
So you obviously... your family moved a lot around a lot. Was it military or just jobs?
It wasn't military. It was actually my parents divorced when I was very young.
Okay.
And they moved a lot, and I got the cross action. And everybody says that, military. I'm like, nope, just a cross action.
Yeah. I mean, but that builds you for who you are. And I've traveled all around the world, and it does change your outlook, and it allows you to become more accustomed to many different people's ways of life. That if you just live in a little small town your entire life, sometimes you're not as accepting to people that others could call odd, strange, or anything like that. And I can see that in your food. You have many layers and dimensions of flavors and styles in the food. So congratulations for the way that you have brought your background and presented it in a wonderful way culinarily.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's been a long trip, and it's been amazing. I've worked at a lot of places, and it's created some good barbecue.
And you mentioned one of the places was Oklahoma, you said?
Not Oklahoma, Colorado.
Colorado.
Yeah.
So where did the love of barbecue come into? Because the places that you mentioned, I didn't hear anything that really that sprung out to me yelling, hey, this was a barbecue location he was at.
Yeah, I never actually worked anywhere that was really barbecue. And we got a little barbecue smoker at my house. It was electric, took pellets, and pitiful, but made good barbecue. And we started pissing around with it all the time. And it just made some really good food. And I started sharing with my friends and my family, and they were like, this is really good barbecue. So
I mean, it's amazing.
We grew up and got bigger, and here we are.
And I will freely say this, Don knows this, and I've said it on air previously on other shows. You have created an atmosphere in South Jersey for a bar that has been set for barbecue. I am a certified barbecue judge, and the way that you have put your game face on, that's the best way I can phrase it, for the restaurant that you have. I've only been to your Mullica Hill location, but it's perfect in every aspect. You come in, you have the meat selection, you can see what you're making, the board is easy to understand, the food is delicious, the barbecue, as you said, is simple, it's smoked, it's quality ingredients. But where you really shine was the way that you set up with sides. Far and beyond, you really shine with the sides, going from lobster mac and cheese to corn chowder, clam chowders, asparagus, cauliflower. You don't normally see that at a barbecue place, and that is a large gripe for many people. They say, well, the meat's great, but what am I going to get, baked beans and cornbread? You took the recipe, and is it that when you went to the Culinary Institute of America, because you don't hear, I shouldn't say that, there's a large majority of what you call barbecue pit masters who aren't classically trained, right, as they say. Is that the part of your classical training that is shining through?
You know, I don't think that's it. That's not where it came from. I mean, that's a good starter, and I went to a lot of people. I went through school with a lot of people that were, you know, some were good, some were not good coming in. And coming out, it was just like, you know, the people who weren't good coming in, some of them got better, some of them didn't. And you're like, this guy's got no job in the culinary business at this point. But, and some just wanted to be like food stylists. So it just depended. But it was all about who you work with. When you come out of culinary school and you go to extern, and I tell everybody I can, and I've sent many, many people on to culinary school, or turned many people that were maybe started as dishwashers and trained them that are now executive chefs. And I'm like, hey, buddy, I need somebody to come work for me. And they're like, chef, I make too much money now, I can't work for you. I'm like, okay. But work for the best people you can. Even if you're not making the best money, work for the best people you can. Go to the best restaurant you can get into and make it work for you.
And you have been lucky enough to work with a certain group of individuals with your background. Why don't you give us a little bit of your background?
I've been fortunate to go all around the country. When I did my externship from the Culinary Institute of America, I went to San Francisco and worked for David and Annie Gingras, who were the people who kind of supported Wolfgang Puck in his restaurant's endeavors before he got really big and became, you know, Wolfgang Puck. But they had a restaurant called I can't remember now. It's been so long. Worked for them for a year. And then one of their sous chefs was opening another restaurant, and he said, come help me open this restaurant for 6 months. I'll pay you good. And, you know, I was like, okay, let's do it. It was called Globe in San Francisco. And Joseph Manzari, fantastic chef, amazing guy. He's got like 7 restaurants now, I think. And then the Culinary Institute of America called me, and they said, hey, internship's supposed to be 6 months. You're at 1.5 years now. If you don't come back, you start over. And I was like, oh, shit, I got to go back.
So, you've put it well. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
I'll see you soon.
Yeah. So I went back.
So obviously you were extremely successful learning under these individuals. You got a lot of skills, a lot of the knowledge, and you've applied it well. Do you miss any aspect of that with 322 Barbecue?
322 Barbecue, I've changed my philosophy a lot. One of the jobs I had years ago now was the executive chef partner for the Ocean Air Seafood Room in Philadelphia. It was a small group of restaurants. I think they had 11 of them at the time. They went under when the economy went and tanked. Unfortunately, it was a great company. But I remember the executive chef for that company coming in and being like, telling us, you guys are working way too hard at this. We were like trying to make it this thing that it didn't necessarily have to be, mm-hmm. and just putting, you know, 25 hours a day in that you didn't have to put in, yeah. and you could make great food still. So I think I've come to learn that it's barbecue. It's not hot cuisine. It's not crazy. It's good food. Buy good ingredients, treat it well, and it comes out well.
And I think you do a quality job that maybe when that creative side of yours does want to spring out, I've noticed a couple times that I've come that shows on your special menu. And I think that where you are differentiating yourself from other barbecue places is I will call you a full-fledged restaurant. I wouldn't just call you a barbecue joint. I would call it a full-fledged restaurant. And I think a lot of people don't understand that of you guys yet because of what barbecue has always been around. I mean, Don, you've been around here for many years. Barbecue wasn't always good around this area.
No, definitely wasn't. You would just get so-so ribs. They were tough. A lot of barbecue sauce, not too much seasoning.
And some people would even call, oh, we're having barbecue tonight. And then you see a rack of ribs being boiled.
Yeah.
And then they're just sprinkling some Kraft whatever on top. Enjoy!
Yeah. They never really knew how to make barbecue here. I mean, I think with the electric smokers helped a lot of people get into the barbecue just for their home use. Where now you have good cherry wood and oak you can find, and you could throw it in there and add that extra flavor and depth to the meat that you're cooking.
So I've never been to your Swedesboro location, but you said that they've been open for 5 years.
Yeah.
You've had some bumps in the road there. You had a fire that almost bankrupted you, and you even lost a partner. And it wasn't easy, but you did overcome them. Let's step back before all of that. Why did you choose Swedesboro as the location to open up out of all places?
It was funny. It just kind of came up. I had a partner in the beginning who owned a big meat distribution center. And so he was meat-centric, definitely. So we'd been trying to work on a restaurant for many years, and nothing ever came together. And finally, I found this spot in Swedesboro that was a small strip mall, basically, that was newly constructed. There was one space left in it. And so I was like, all right, let me call these guys and see what's going on. And the owner of the strip mall loved the idea. He loved it so much that he was willing to put some money into fitting it out.
That's when you know you're on a good
idea. So I went to my partner at the time, and he's like, okay, we'll try something out. And we had the idea of he wanted a butcher shop. I wanted a barbecue shop and a restaurant, so we split 50-50, and we have full butcher shop, a full barbecue shop, and all kinds of gourmet stuff. I think we've got the best cheesesteak going on the East Coast. It's part of our smoked brisket and smoked ribeye steak that we take and blend together. It's come together a lot.
That sounds delicious.
Oh, yeah. It sure does.
I'm mad that I haven't had that yet. But I have, every time I go, I have the ribs, and I'm satisfied.
Yeah, you wouldn't think of a barbecue place to have a cheesesteak.
But that's what I said. You've truly transformed the game in South Jersey. So you have the ability to go there for takeout cheesesteak if you just want something quick and whatever you want, or sit down and enjoy it. And it's a shame I haven't been to your Swedesboro location because I keep mentioning the Mullica Hill. But the Mullica Hill location also is very family-centric. You have games set up on the table. So it's truly a night out sort of experience when you're going there. And that's what a lot of restaurateurs are missing out. They're only looking at the business aspect of it. Oh, how can I share a business? Instead of saying, you know what, we're going to make it a night out. You're going to enjoy it. And I'm going to serve you delicious food.
Yeah. We talk to my staff all the time. I have a couple core managers that we talk about all the time. And we actually, this is something that comes up all the time because we have a very extensive menu. And we're like, is this too much? Can we pare it back? And they're like, well, if you take this away, they're going to complain. If you take this away, they're going to complain. And the menu really builds on everything else that it starts at. So it's not like you're carrying all this crazy stuff, but we just do different things with it.
You're just spinning it in different ways. This way you're keeping the food costs down, but it's all the same different combinations of food in different ways.
Yeah, we waste nothing. We try to use everything.
And that's the way that you have to do it. And also, you are putting your best foot forward with community events. For example, you're going to be present at the Swedesboro Woolwich Day, which is Saturday, September 28th, because many people think it's wonderful, and they have a food truck, Don. Can you believe that?
Food trucks are very difficult from what I understand, but I'm sure.
But he will come to you. If you're the customer, you're not worried about how difficult it is.
Very true.
Yeah, the food trucks are definitely a pain, but we love it. And we get to show a lot of new people our barbecue style.
And for these sort of events, obviously you have to pare the menu down.
Oh, yeah.
What's the normal setup for when we see you at events like these?
So with the food truck, we actually, when I got the food truck, it was a I got it cheap, used, and it had been next to a building that burned. So I got it very cheap because the side was kind of peeling off. And so we repaired it ourselves, and then we had it wrapped, and it's beautiful now. But we do brisket sandwiches, pulled pork sandwiches, pulled chicken sandwiches. We got a fryer on there now, so we're doing French fries, brisket mac and cheese, lobster mac and cheese. It depends where you find it. Sometimes we'll be running taco trucks. It depends. It depends on what we're for the day and the event, but we do a lot of different stuff.
And you've been wildly successful with both restaurants and the food truck. And as you mentioned, there's only so many hours in a day, and it depends how much you want to work. But one of your dreams is to have a restaurant empire. Why don't you go into that? What would be your exact dream? To own the empire yourself, franchising, because that brings its own headaches into it, where you've got to worry about quality control and things like that. So what would be the dream for you?
I think franchising is a no-starter, because unless you have exactly the right person, you'd be ridiculous to take on this task. Because you have a full butcher shop, we make everything in-house, you've got just everything's done there. So unless you've been an experienced restaurateur already, you've been put through the paces, you'd be lost going into this. You'd probably, you'd be lost. It'd be bad. So I think the future could be opening more of these, going to larger locations, possibly a liquor license. I could really see a honky-tonk kind of ploy with this thing, with a liquor license, a bar, bands, and barbecue all goes well together. And my wife tells me constantly, I've worked in a lot of really high-end Asian restaurants. She's like, you need to open something Asian around here, like Budokan style Asian in South Philly. So we'll
and
see.
I will say that's one thing I haven't seen too much on the menu, but if that is your style, what about some Asian barbecue flavors?
Oh, definitely. We could hit some of those. This week we just introduced a couple new things. We introduced a habanero peach sauce for our wings. Mm. And the peaches are coming out of our Holzer Farms in Mullica Hill. And we introduced a blueberry barbecue sauce, which is banging. the habanero peach one's hot as hell, but the blueberry one's just nice and rounded out if you're not willing to take the heat. So we're trying some new things.
What would you say is your personal favorite item on the menu?
Brisket. We sell 1,000 pounds of brisket a week. The brisket is phenomenal. It's like, it's cooked for 12 hours. It's tender. It's moist. It's got a good bark on it. It's just, it's phenomenal. The brisket's number one.
What was your favorite out of all of this, Don?
I like the candied bacon.
You're on point with my wife, because that is one of her favorite things when we go there. She always gets at least three of them whenever we go.
Yeah.
And
they're addictive.
they certainly are.
Well, it's funny because I tell people when they ask, people always ask, we have this jewelry case of meat when you walk in, and it's heated and it's beautiful, and it's like, it's my jewelry that we sell at the restaurant. It's brisket, pork, and the triple smoked candied bacon. Since we introduced that product about 3 or 4 years ago, it's become one of our best sellers, and it's just crazy. It's like crack. And we tell people, be careful, because when you take it to your party, the next day I get like, they take like 50 slices to a party, I get like 3 or 4 people coming in and being like, what the heck was that? It was so good.
What was the most difficult thing of everything on the menu? Which item was trial and error, and it was a struggle, and then you got it right, and it was that aha moment?
I think it was in the very beginning. There was like 6 or 8 of us. I'd hired a whole new crew 5 years ago, right? All these new guys I'd never met. And I had a partner put this money in, and I put some money in, and we're trying to develop this new restaurant. And he's like, okay, you've been messing around for like 5 days. He's like, get open. We're out of money. We don't have any more money. So he's like, get open. So it was the dry rub. Like, we were just messing around with this dry rub constantly and cooking stuff and trying to see what worked best. But to come up with this dry rub recipe, It's crazy, and it's good on everything. We put it on our salmon, on the wings, on the brisket, on the pork. It goes in some of the mac and cheeses. It's like, it's just crazy.
But that's the moment that you know that you finally hit it.
Yeah.
And it's a testament to yourself that, like you said, your 6 days passed when you were supposed to, but you weren't going to put out a product that you weren't happy with. So, and it shows.
You can't rush perfection.
Yeah.
No. But
it takes time.
It was a joy to have you in studio. Every single thing that we had was delicious. And I really beg everyone to go to 322 Barbecue if you've never been to either location.
You definitely won't be disappointed.
Now, the one thing that I can say was the first time that I visited 322 Barbecue, if you would like to replicate that, was... We were driving down the Mullica Hill. We stopped in 322 Barbecue for dinner on a cold December night, and then we continued our way down the Creamy Acres for their Christmas hayride. And that was the first time we went there. It was us and a bunch of friends, and we've been back many, many times. So thank you very much for that. And we here at Small Bites are very big fans of yours.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your business.
But talking about wonderful things, Don, and being extremely popular things to do, we've got someone online who knows all about that. That would be Gemma Statford of Bigger Boulder Baking, A Fearless Approach to Baking Anytime, Anywhere, which is her new cookbook out. And Don, she has 1.9 million subscribers and 170 million views on YouTube. And I'm sort of jealous with that because, as you know very well, Don, we could never be YouTube stars because both of us have faces made for radio. But Gemma has been wildly successful, and congratulations to her. But we want to talk about her book now. How's it going tonight, Gemma?
It's going good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is our pleasure. So you're originally from Ireland, and you had a passion for baking with a big family to feed. So what was it that you said to yourself, you know what, baking is going to be where it's at, and I need to share this with people on YouTube, and you've been wildly successful. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, so I grew up in a large Irish household when I was baking with my mom, and it was the only thing I ever wanted to do as a kid. So it was either when I was young, you know, you kind of just choose your profession. I either wanted to be a chef or a teacher, and I went to college to be a chef. And my mom said to me, I remember very clearly when I was filling out my application form, she said, "Don't go be a chef because you'll work very long hours and you'll earn very little money." And she was absolutely dead right, because that's what I did for 10 plus years, and that's what happens. But I worked all around the world in different kitchens. I worked as a private chef in Italy and in Australia, working a ski season. And until I moved to the United States 10 years ago, I worked in a Michelin star restaurant in San Francisco. And it was only until around 6 years ago or so, my husband and I, we decided that we wanted to try something new. We wanted to do something together. And he has a background in entertainment and marketing. He worked for Lucasfilm and Disney. And so we kind of combined both of our passions, and we realized where that road kind of intersected was digital, digital and food. So we started creating YouTube videos.
Yeah, I mean, and they're great. The production value is wonderful. They're not drawn out. They're entertaining. And I think you've really hit the nail on the head, and that's probably why you're so successful. And now you've come out with this wonderful cookbook. But why don't you tell our audience, what is Bigger Boulder Baking?
Well, Bigger Boulder Baking is all about taking risks. And about, you know, a little bit like the subtitle of the book, A Fearless Approach to Baking, for anybody, anytime, anywhere. So I really try and crack the code with a lot of recipes. You know, I worked as a professional chef for many years, but in the book and on Bigger Boulder Baking, on my website, I really try to just focus on the bare bones of exactly what you need for a recipe, because sometimes with baking, the recipes can become very long-winded and very technical. And I try and get across all that information, but just take away all the fluffy stuff and the stuff that, you know, can confuse you and the stuff that you don't need, and get straight to brass tacks. And that's the way that, like, I read a recipe. It's the way that I learned, you know, and that has been really positive with our audience.
And you've really taken that concept. And as you said, a lot of people are intimidated by baking because just a little bit of the wrong ingredient can dramatically change the results of what you expected to pop out of the oven. And you took a lot of your experience, and you have beginner recipes really that people with no experience whatsoever can do in the book. Do you want to talk about a couple of those?
Sure. Well, so the book is broken down into chapters rather than cookies and cakes and ice creams. It's a little bit less traditional. I broke it down into the biggest pieces of kitchen equipment you'll need. And I started out with wooden spoon and bowl, which is deliberately the first chapter because I thought, number one, that the book is for everybody. I really catered. I catered for the 7-year-old Gemma who loves to make cookies, and I also catered for the 30-something Gemma who, like, has a dinner party and needs to feed people. And I started out with wooden spoon and bowl. So when you pick up the book, if you are a novice or beginner or a fair weather baker, you can start there with those recipes where you don't need special equipment and you don't need a stand mixer or a hand mixer. And you can get stuck into a whole chapter with cookies and crumbles and crisps and different things. You'd be really surprised the desserts that you can make just you doing it by hand.
And one of the ones that I found that really caught my interest, because I'm really addicted to ice cream, was the 3-ingredient no churn vanilla ice cream. And it was simple enough even for me to do, Don.
It came out good.
It was delicious.
That's one thing a lot of people are afraid of baking is the ingredients. You put too much, not enough. It comes out different every time. But I think that's what a lot of people are afraid of baking, where your book makes that a lot easier.
But I didn't have to bake the no churn vanilla ice cream. Otherwise, it would have just turned into milk.
Wow.
Shake. that is one of our favorites. That's one of our fan favorites, is the 3-ingredient ice cream. And, you know, you ask about, like, what is bold baking? And I really try and show people an alternative way to do something that's something quite traditional. So usually with an ice cream, like, to make ice cream at home, you'd, like, have to have an ice cream machine and you'd have to make a traditional custard. And you know, that's not the case. With my 3-ingredient ice cream, I'll give away the secret that it's cream, condensed milk, and a little bit of vanilla. And you mix it all up with a hand mixer or a stand mixer, not having the need for an ice cream machine. And it's one of our most popular videos on YouTube, in the tens of millions of views. And, you know, it's not about, and same also in the book, the Bigger Bolder Baking Cookbook, I have a few of my microwave recipes. And it's not about cooking in the microwave. It's not about cooking without an ice cream machine. It's about a community of people who love to bake, who still want to do it, but they didn't have all the means that they think they have or they need to make these desserts.
And also with the summer season now departing and fall coming in, and it's getting a little bit chillier, some people don't like to bake as often in the summer because it's already going to make a hot house even hotter. But with the fall, you've got the leaves coming and hot chocolate or a nice espresso, Don, and probably you could help people out.
Pumpkin spice.
Yeah, a little pumpkin spice. What would you say is one of your favorite fall recipes?
So I do a little bit of a double whammy. I have a whole chapter in the book that is no oven needed. So you don't, you know, a lot of it is done in a wooden spoon and bowl or different pieces of equipment, but you don't actually need to turn on your oven to do it. And one of my favorites in that chapter for the holiday season, especially for Thanksgiving, now that I've been here in the United States for 11 years, is there's a crock pot gingerbread pudding. And it is, it is essentially a traditional Irish gingerbread pudding, gingerbread that we eat a lot at home. And I make a kind of caramel sauce to go over it. And I, on Thanksgiving, I do this. I've been doing it for the last few years. You know, when the turkey's in the oven and everything else is busy and I was nominated to make dessert, I stick a crock pot in the other corner of the room and you put it on in the morning and you leave it there for hours on end. And the cake just gets better and better and it steams and it's really moist. So you have a beautiful warm dessert for Thanksgiving dinner and you didn't have to take up space in the oven and get in people's way.
Well, I mean, you've definitely got all bases covered in this book. Like you said, even if it's hot, you don't need to worry about that. You don't even have to turn the oven on. So this book is covering everything that you could possibly want. But one thing before you go, because I'm always interested to hear from people from other areas because I've traveled all around the world, and there's always usually one thing that I eat somewhere that I really miss of what I had there. Like, for example, when I go to the Netherlands, I always miss fresh, right there, herring or stroop waffles. What's one thing that you crave in the States that you can't wait till you get back to Ireland to have?
I shouldn't admit this, but I'm going to. It is sausages. We have our sausages are very different. I find the sausages in the United States, they're really big. And maybe is that I think ours are just kind of blended differently, but Irish sausages are absolutely one of my favorite things. So when I go home, I always buy what we call a slice pan, which is just a regular pack of sliced white bread, Irish butter and sausages. And I would eat the whole pack by myself. Absolutely adore them.
But that's the wonders of, as you said, it leaps at, I can't even speak now. It at least gives you something to look forward to when you return. And I think that's what makes a trip special. So, but thank you so much.
Yeah, it's nostalgic.
Yes, exactly. But thank you so much for joining us, Gemma. We want everyone to go out and purchase Bigger, Bolder Baking, A Fearless Approach to Baking Anytime, Anywhere. And if you haven't gone already, why don't you join her YouTube channel with Bigger, Bolder Baking. We wish you all the best of luck. Do you want to go with a website or any social medias before you go?
Sure. All of those things are biggerbolderbaking.com or biggerbolderbaking on Instagram and Facebook.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
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 So we were talking about things that are very iconic to her when she wants to return to Ireland, but probably one of the most iconic brands that anyone around the world can think of is American. And that would be Coca-Cola, Don. I'm sure you've enjoyed a nice cold Coca-Cola here and there.
I enjoy Coca-Cola.
It's a quality beverage.
Yes, it is.
But we have a gentleman online with us who went and researched the story of the famed Coca-Cola Trail. And that would be, let's see if we get this name correct, Larry Jurgensen.
You got it, Derek. That's me.
Look at that. So
we're ready to talk about Coca-Cola.
Exactly. And he wrote a book called The Coca-Cola Trail, and it's about the people and the places in the history of Coca-Cola. So what drew you to write this book? Are you one of these individuals that you had to have four or five Cokes a day, and you're like, you know what? I'm really interested in how this came about.
I enjoy Coca-Cola, but the real reason the book happened is I was doing a little research on not Atlanta. Everybody, when you say Coca-Cola, they say, oh, Atlanta. Well, what I found out was that Coca-Cola was first bottled in Vicksburg, Mississippi, 5 years before the Coca-Cola Corporation even considered making Coca-Cola a bottled beverage. We had an interesting situation where a gentleman in Mississippi who had a soda fountain and also was buying the Coca-Cola syrup decided he would try to bottle it. And he did. And he bottled away and became very successful with it. And it was 5 years later that Coca-Cola finally said, you know, maybe bottling's not a bad idea. And that's really what triggered the growth across the nation of Coca-Cola.
So with this growth, what, in your opinion, contributed most to the early growth and popularity of Coca-Cola?
Well, what happened is that Coca-Cola, the rights to bottle Coca-Cola were granted to two young men from Chattanooga, and by the way, for $1. And they had the rights to bottle Coca-Cola throughout the United States. Well, they got back to Chattanooga and realized that was sort of an impossible mission when between the two of them, they had $1,500. So, you know, what do we do? Well, they had the rights. They started selling territory, franchises, to bottle Coca-Cola. And consequently, you had entrepreneurs across the country that saw the potential, invested whatever money they could get together, and started bottling Coca-Cola. Well, what could make a product grow faster than businessmen all over the country investing their time and money and effort to make that product a success? That is really the key to the growth of Coca-Cola and ultimately the Coca-Cola empire throughout the world, because it became so successful here.
And also, as you said, everyone is getting into the bottling game. But specifically, what a lot of people really enjoy is that old style Coca-Cola bottle unique design, the old style one. What is the history of the bottle and its creation? Who created that?
Well, the bottle was created actually in 1906. It was authorized. There was a competition in 1905 by the Coca-Cola Company. And they said to the glass bottle manufacturers in the United States, we want a bottle that when you pick it up in your hands, you know it's Coca-Cola. We want it to be distinctive. And they challenged the bottle makers to create the bottle that we know today. Well, in 1905, the bottle makers, and there were five of them, presented their best at a meeting in Atlanta. And the bottle that we know today was selected and became adopted as the Coca-Cola bottle. It was manufactured by the Root Glass Company of Terre Haute, Indiana. And that became the standard. Later, other glass companies were allowed to manufacture it. But it became very distinctive, and you know it's a Coca-Cola when you see that bottle.
Mm-hmm. I mean, without a doubt. And also, there's always been sort of that myth and Mythbusters thing of Coca-Cola's connection to the coca plant, which, of course, is one of the main ingredients of cocaine. What did you find out about that? What was it, more myth or is it more truth?
Well, it's a little of each. The Coca-Cola syrup was developed by a gentleman in Atlanta who was suffering from a Civil War injury and was seeking relief. And he created the syrup using, in fact, cocaine. But it didn't take long before Coca-Cola Corporation realized that was not a good idea.
So the Coca-Cola made sales take off, today, I'm sure, though.
Well, the Coca-Cola we know today does have the coca leaf in it. It has extract from the leaf, but it does not have cocaine. And, of course, it has the cola nut, the two basic ingredients, and others. Who knows what the formula is? They won't tell us. But it's the coca leaf and it's the cola nut that create the basic taste in Coca-Cola. It is not cocaine anymore, and it was only for a short period of time.
Now, did you find it fascinating? Because I think I did. I didn't realize how many people really collected Coca-Cola merchandise. I mean, this is a very...
It's amazing.
Yes. What do you think that comes from?
It's the number one... I think it comes from the fact that Coca-Cola is so involved within the communities they're in. you have local businessmen that are promoting the product. They're getting involved. They're sponsoring things. They're creating memories. They're creating, when you look at that Coca-Cola logo, you've got a memory, whether it was something that happened when you were in high school or somewhere down the line. And that's what triggers, it's like, you know, some people collect beer cans.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. It reflects a pleasant time in your life. The Coca-Cola collectors are international. They have chapters all over the United States. They have chapters in Japan and Australia and China and everywhere. And they meet. They have local meetings where they swap and tell stories. And they just completed a month ago their annual convention in Atlanta. And hundreds of them get together with some very valuable and some not so valuable Coca-Cola memorabilia. And once a year, they have the big convention, which next July will be in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Wow.
So, you know, anybody that's in Green Bay around July 7th, there's going to be a big gathering of Coca-Cola memorabilia collectors.
Well, the book is fascinating. It was a joy to talk to you. It's really interesting to find out the history of, as you said, an international powerhouse brand. I don't think that there's an edge of this earth that I've been to that someone doesn't know the Coca-Cola brand. And I've been to a lot of places, and someone, at least one person, has a Coca-Cola somewhere. I want everyone to go out to purchase The Coca-Cola Trail. It's a book about the people, the places, and the history of Coca-Cola. Larry, it was a joy talking to you, and I hope you have yourself a great night.
Thank you, Derek. I enjoyed the opportunity to talk to you and to your listeners. Appreciate it. Thank you much.
No problem. Have a good one. Well, Don, from one beverage that will get you pepped up and ready to go, to another one that if you're feeling a little down and out, need a little energy and something tasty, we've got the perfect person to talk to. And that would be online. Cold Brew, King's Brew Coffee. And it's going to be Chef Craig Shelton, who is a James Beard Foundation Award winner. And he has King's Row Coffee, King's Brew Nitro Cold Brew Selection. And that's right up your alley, isn't it, Don?
Yeah, cold brew has really taken off in the last 10 years or so, where nobody goes, oh, I don't drink my coffee cold. That's impossible. No, nobody does. But it's really starting to take off.
Well, we have Craig online with us. How's it going tonight, Craig? Why don't you tell us a little bit about it and what the product is?
Well, what an honor to be on your show. I'm so grateful. And, King's Row Coffee, I started this concept when I was the chef de cuisine of Boulay Restaurant way back in the late 80s, 1980s, until about 1991, when I started the Ryland Inn. And it was shocked me back in those days was the greatest restaurants in America were serving crappy coffee. I mean, truly crappy. And I would ask why, and they would always say, because you get the equipment for free. And people didn't understand, I guess, what the concept of an amortization payment is. But we're really excited about this cold brew coffee we call Chef's Brew. The company itself was founded on the idea of cost be damned. Since I was really doing it for my own restaurant, I didn't care what my coffee cost for me. I wanted to serve my customers the absolute finest cup of coffee on earth. And we started with a number of brand new ideas. No one had ever thought of this before. First was to say, I happened to have studied the neurophysiology of the senses at Yale University. My degree is in molecular biophysics and biochemistry, and the greatest expert in the world on this subject is Gordon Shepherd, professor there when I was there. And so we begin to understand that, you know, what you eat will change the flavor of the thing that follows. What you drink will change the flavor of the food that follows, and things like this. And so we also knew that the environment that you're in, if you're right next to the seashore and the brine is in the air, it'll change the flavor of food. If you're at elevation, it can change things. And so the whole idea was to create a dynamic, interactive kind of coffee. The second difference was this. Back then, any good coffee was a single type of coffee. Anyone who made blends did it only to save money. Basically, they'd use a tiny bit of something good and then a bunch of stuff that was filler and then a way to, you know, to make profit. I wanted to take exactly the opposite approach. Kind of like in the world of wine, well, you can contrast two different winemaking styles in Bordeaux, for example, versus Burgundy. In Burgundy, they can make extraordinary white wine from a single grape, the Chardonnay. Or they can make an extraordinary wine from a red wine from a single grape, the Pinot Noir. But not so in Bordeaux. In Bordeaux, they need to use as many as 6 different grapes, blended all to their own personal recipes. And so this is the approach we took. We found that we could make an even better cup of coffee using this mix of 6 different, 7 different, 5 different types of beans from all over the globe. And then the third a major difference happened, which was broadband roasting. We were the first to ever do this, and I'm not sure if anyone else has done it yet, in which each one of those different elements in the coffee is roasted to a different level, so that one of these coffees might be used for the high notes, another one for the very dark notes, some for the middle, etc. Finally, we said quality has to be the ultimate. So whereas most of the big brand coffees, you know, the beans can be in their warehouse for 6 months before they even get to the grocery store. Whereas when you order from us, generally that coffee has been roasted only 2 to 3 days beforehand, before we ship it. So generally within a week. Finally, optimal nutritional. So this is where we get into the whole cold brew thing. Okay, well, I looked out there and I said, cold brew is a wonderful product for young people, especially today, but most of it is nearly toxic with 17, 18 grams of sugar per small can. And, you know, in a world in which metabolic syndrome is bringing early death to 60% of us, I thought we should make something that had all of the flavor, all of the wonderful mouthfeel with none of the calories, none of the carbs. So we have a proprietary type of nitro process. No one else has. It's patented. And what it does, no pasteurization is required. So you have the ultimate, just like it was brewed yesterday in the can, the ultimate high quality, but 180-day shelf life of the product with optimal flavor, and then our cost is lower than our nearest competitors who don't have anywhere near the kind of quality, but the second best is going to be a lot more expensive than ours. And so that's why we're so excited about it all.
Wow, I mean, it's a wonderful product. And
I have to agree with Greg that there is a lot of bad coffee out there, and unfortunately a lot of people do look for
the cheapest
way to go. But I understand how is one of the best ways to consume a nitro coffee? Greg?
Well, the thing is, we have like 5 or 6. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we have a few, you know, we have like 5. We launched with just original, you know, black coffee, and then we just recently created some new interesting ones. So you're purists like me. I just drink it black. I don't even like sugar in any drinks. But for people who like a faint amount of sugar, you know, we're doing something unique also where we're cold brewing it with real maple water. You know, like they make maple syrup from, you tap a maple tree and out comes the wonderful juice from it. Well, so it's 1 gram. You know, I think it's 5 grams of effective sugar in that, but it's an absolutely natural product with so many phytochemicals in it and phytonutrients. I think it's a really rational and healthful way to go, like the midway point. Maybe you're not ready to go full out, you know, purist, but this is something that we found with our customers.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many thousands of people have said to us, you know, we used to drink milk and sugar with our coffee until we discovered King's Row. Now we don't need it anymore. This stuff is so amazing all by itself.
And it's a great product. And the flavors include original black, bourbon and butter, mushroom mocha, decaf cappuccino. And the thing that I like is King's Brew never uses more than a single gram of organic sugarcane in each can, thanks to the nitro process. And this is Don's a big coffee person, DNL Coffee Services. I know this is definitely something that you'll be looking into and trying and fiddling around with. So we want to thank you so much, Chef Craig Shelton, for coming on, the founder of King's Brew Nitro Cold Brew. And do you want to give us a website or anything like that before you go?
It's kingsrowcoffee.com.
Perfect. Thank you.
And we have stores, thank you, all over the country, and they're growing every day.
Awesome. Well, we couldn't be happy for you, and we want everyone to go out and give it a try. Have a great night.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Well, somebody else who I'm always excited to talk to, let's see if she knows about Nitro Cold Brew Coffee, because she's always hip with the latest trends, and you have to be hip in order to be named Pennsylvania's most influential chef, as named by Cooking Light magazine, and that would be Chef Barbie Marshall. How's it going tonight, Chef Barbie? Chef Barbie?
I love coffee. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. I guess you were just taking a last sip of that coffee.
I'm in the car. I'm crossing the bridge. I'm coming from Jersey.
Well,
it smells probably terrible.
I'm glad that you're being safe while you're talking to us.
Well, I'm on my hands free.
Okay, so it's...
And I am being safe.
No problem. I wasn't saying that you weren't.
But I was still listening.
Excellent.
And I do love myself some coffee. And I agree that I don't like sugar in my coffee, but I do like a little bit of milk or cream. And I find that the sugar that's in the milk or cream is all that I need. Like the natural sugars of milk or cream
is all I need. You're sweet enough all by yourself.
I am. When I want to be. But only when I want to be.
So what's hot and happening this week?
You know what just was hot and happening today? I discovered King's Row Brewery, and I was over there. And it's not a small bite, but it was a big gulp. And it was nice. I just had a nice IPA from them, which leads me into, I also just found Glory Beer Bar in Philly, which was absolutely amazing. So I'm going back there this week so that I can tell you all about, like, all the yummy stuff. That was the best bowl of French fries that I've ever had in a restaurant, I got to tell you.
Well, that has to be impressive to... To wow you to be the best bowl of French fries ever, I would be definitely interested to give them a try. What was so yummy about them?
They were crispy, number one. They were seasoned well and just usually, well, what I found is sometimes you get fries and they're just soggy and it's like, why am I wasting all these calories on something fried that's not crispy? And they were just perfect.
Well.
So, and I also got some calamari from them, and the pairings for the dishes that I got were just amazing. It's so amazing that I have to go back.
Well.
Like, that's how amazing it was.
And that's Glory, you said?
So, Glory Beer Bar and Kitchen.
Okay.
It's an old city, and an old friend of mine who actually was bartender at Eulogy, and I'll tell you how far back it was. Opened it, and it's about a year old,
okay.
And I just didn't realize that it was there. And so there's a lot of hot, fresh, new openings for the fall, especially around Old City. I'm going to be going out and checking some of those out, too. So I'll tell you all about them. Give me some time. And next week, you know what next week is? 15th? Restaurant week. So perfect opportunity to go out and try some new things, because you can get a three-course dinner for $35, you know, and you try a new restaurant, and they'll want to go back.
So you can take me out next week, Don.
There you go.
Well,
we'll go on the road.
Thank you so much, yep. Chef Barbie. Keep the eyes on the road and signal ahead, but it was a pleasure talking to you.
Always.
Have a good night.
Good night, Barb.
That was fun, Don.
Yes, it was.
Did you enjoy yourself, David?
I did. It was a great time. Thank you, Joyce.
Well, it was certainly our pleasure. And I think that Gemma was a joy to talk to because you never really think about baking when you don't have to bake. So that's an interesting spin of things that you're really not baking.
One less step.
Faking, I guess, maybe.
No bake.
No. We have to think of a term.
It's like the old refrigerator cakes.
Yeah. Why don't we go around the room real quick? 10 seconds to say your name and whatever you want real quick.
All right. This is David Wiederholt from 322 Barbecue. You can find us at 322barbecue.com in Mullica Hill, New Jersey. We got some of the best barbecue happening on the East Coast and a ton of awards to prove it. So come see us.
Perfect.
Donato Marino, D&L Coffee Service. You can find us on Facebook. And that's it.
Good find.
Short and sweet.
There you go. It's short and sweet sometimes.
But we have a lot of good reviews, and everybody's happy with our service. And I'm sure you get your filters changed on your coffee machines.
There you go. The words of wisdom. I like it. Maybe we'll have that. A coffee tip of the week ending the show.
Okay.
Adding to your workload. I'm Derek Tibb of BlueJeanFood.com. This is Small Bites. We're live Sundays on WildfireRadio.com. Catch us the following day on all of your Apple products on iTunes. We're syndicated on many AM stations. Just Google us to find out. There's too many to mention. And we end the show like we always do with a joke of the week from the legendary joke teller, Jackie the Joke Man Martlin.
Hi, this is Jackie Martling for Small Bites. A lady sitting in a restaurant when a waiter walks by scratching his butt. She says, "Waiter, do you have hemorrhoids?" He says, "Just what's on the menu, lady." What food is certain to kill a woman's sex drive? Wedding cake. I'm Jackie Martling, and I tweet a joke every day at 4:20 p.m. Follow me on Twitter, @JackieMartling.